Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, legendary Hall of Fame musician Robbie Robertson from the band comes in and lays out a very revealing interview. I've learned there's much to that guy, much, much deeper than just the music side of him and the band. And Good Sports is coming as well. First, LifeLock. Predator the Thief malware is back. It can steal usernames, passwords, browsers, data, cryptocurrency, as well as taking photos with the infected victim's webcam. Every time you bank, shop, or browse online, you can be vulnerable to cyber criminals. Norton and LifeLock are now part of one company. Norton 360 with LifeLock is an all-in-one membership for your cyber safety. You get device security, identity theft protection, and VPN for online privacy. If there's an identity theft problem, their specialists will work hard to fix it. But you won't have a problem because you got LifeLock. They're the industry standards. 2020, protect yourself with LifeLock, right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all cybercrime and identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but Norton 360 with LifeLock is a powerful ally for your cyber safety. Until March 8th, save up to 40% off your first order. Go to Norton.com/Adam. That's Norton.com/Adam for 40% off. Adam Carolla is unprepared all winter long.
Well, Kimmel dead, Adam again on stage in free ball. Totally unprepared with no material at all. He's gonna go,
he's gonna go.
He doesn't know,
doesn't know
what the hell he's gonna say until you tell him so.
He's gonna go,
he's gonna go.
He doesn't know,
doesn't know
until you give him an idea.
Written out a ball. Get your ticket for the show. What word awaits? He's gonna go,
he's gonna go.
Don't miss Adam Carolla is Unprepared. Aces in Cleveland, Ohio at Hilarities on February 27th and Indianapolis at Helium on February 28th and 29th. And at Helium in St. Louis on April 10th and 11th. Get prepared for Adam Carolla is Unprepared by getting your tickets now at adamcarolla.com.
Robbie Robertson is in the studio. Documentary Once We're Brothers. It's Robbie Robertson and the band. I saw The Last Waltz in the theater when it came out in 1976, '77, or trying to think of seven when it was. So it's great to finally be in your company.
Did they play the movie loud where you saw it?
I do. I believe I went with a friend's dad. I was a young guy, and he, you know, he went. My buddy Chris's dad, Rick, took us. And it's not the kind of movie that 13-year-olds normally want to see per se. But I remember thinking this was great, and we were listening to the band on the way in and sort of on the way out to prime ourselves. And it,
well,
I remember
it says,
enjoying it
at the beginning of the movie. Martin Scorsese had them. You know, it says in the movie, play this movie loud. So that's why I was asking if they followed orders.
I think the theater was rocking, as okay. if memory serves.
Okay.
So now the second, The Last Waltz was about the band's last tour, right? And then now Once We're Brothers is coming out in select theaters this Friday. Bob Dylan's making appearances, Scorsese, Springsteen, Clapton, David Geffen. It's got all this. So as I was reading about you this morning, I went to the hand doctor, and I was sitting in there, and I thought, well, I got some time on my hands, pardon the pun. So I took a deep dive into you, and I did not know all these things about you. I didn't know how prolific you were on the movie side of music. And I also didn't know about your past and your biological dad dying in a being as a pedestrian changing a tire and being clipped by somebody. So why don't we start at the start? You grew up in Canada.
Yeah, I grew up between Toronto and the Six Nation Indian Reserve. That's where my mom was born and raised, and yeah, my blood father, he got killed before I was born. And so I didn't realize it until some years later, But being half Jewish and half North American Indian was a really odd combination.
Yeah.
You know, everybody would say, I'm Irish and I'm Italian and
right.
I'm, you know, all of these different things. And they'd say, and what are you? And when I would say it, they'd said, well, you should just wait in the car because that doesn't fit in anywhere.
Yeah, I've never heard it. You hear half Indian or something, but the other half isn't Jewish. But did you know this whole biological father killed story early? Because there was another man in your mom was marrying, right, at the time.
Robertson, yeah. He was, he was the dad that I grew up with until I was like 12, 13 years old. And then they decided to go their separate ways. And my mother, it says this in the movie. And one day my mother said to me, there's something I should tell you. And maybe I should have told you this before, but he's not your father. And I was so stunned. I didn't even have the words to say, well, who is? I just was like, what?
That has to be, you know, people say like earth shattering or something, but mostly just confusing. Like, I feel like I would just have to process that, like all the times he came to the school and all the catches we had and all the times we had the father-son picnic or something. Like, did he know it?
I don't know whether he believed it. My mother had said this to him. I think when they...
At that time or before that time?
I'm not sure about before that time because I was probably too young to know what was going on. But when they were... Robertson, he became quite violent with my mother and with me too. And so when she was leaving, she was leaving in a gust of wind. You know, she was like, I got to get out of here. And in anger.
Was his name Jim?
Yes.
Okay. So Jim was on, he was in the military or out on reserve or something, right?
Yeah, yeah. That was when they first, were going out together.
Right. So just so I can piece this timeline together, because I find this...
It's tricky.
...endlessly fascinated. He's out on duty. He's, you know, overseas or somewhere. She has sex with a Jewish guy, becomes pregnant with you, then he comes back and they get married. He thinks you're his kid, possibly. Probably. If he was a violent guy, she probably didn't want to bring up the guy who was killed by the side of the road.
He wasn't early on. He wasn't, you know.
Right.
This grew into something.
He matured into violence.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, there's time. There's still hope for all of us, gents. So I'm guessing your mom wasn't upfront about that with him.
Here's what the thing was, that she knew Robertson. But they weren't going to get married. And then while he was away, she was working at this place with Kligerman.
Mm-hmm. And they biological dad.
And they started going out together. And then he wrote her a letter saying, when I get back, I would really like for us to get married.
Jim wrote that.
Jim.
Right.
And after Kligerman got killed, she said yes.
Right.
And then he came back, you know, not too long after that, they got married, and that's how come it connected smoother than what you would think.
Did you look like him? What was his heritage?
No, I didn't. I didn't look like him. Hip Robertson, he was kind of a, you know, they're... background was probably Scottish and Irish and stuff like that.
Did you feel anything? I mean, was there a sort of sense of like, who is this guy? Or I don't feel like a kind of a cosmic connection or that maybe an invisible connection that maybe a father and a son might have.
He was, I didn't have a strong connection with him because I couldn't relate to his interests. And I just thought, well, you know, we're just different people and, And I like what I like, and, you know, he likes his other stuff.
You like music, he likes cars and beating his family, and so, so first off, congratulations on being in the band, because it's funny, God, we couldn't get any further away, but, like, Huey Lewis was sitting where you were sitting yesterday, and I interviewed Huey Lewis in the news, and I realized Huey's a great guy, and he's a really good musician, and he plays the harmonica really well, but he's Huey Lewis in the news. Like, he doesn't get the street cred, you know, that the band gets. Like, the band is that sort of 20 years ago, if somebody said, who's killer band? They just go Radiohead. People go Radiohead. They just give it an answer. Like, I don't even know how good Radiohead is, but they would just say Radiohead. And in the 70s and in the 80s, people just go, the band. I'm into the band. That was a band that was just synonymous with quality. You know what I'm saying? Like, some bands earn their reputation, then there are other bands that are good. They just don't really get that love. You know what I mean? But you happen to form a band that just was a great band and got so much credit, so much credibility. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it had to do with a few connections. One was that we were together probably 6 years before we made Music from Big Pink, mm-hmm. our first album.
We'd
been doing the workshop. We'd been paying our dues on the road. We'd been playing the Chitlin circuit down south all the way up to Canada. And we were gathering musicalities. Mm-hmm. We were on a mission to do something musically extraordinary. We weren't a group that was like, God, let's take our shirts off and hopefully we'll be big pop stars or something. We came in on a different train. And so when we did make our first album, we'd already been through the mill. We'd played Jack Ruby's club.
Right.
You know, we had done it all. So already at that point. And then we hooked up with, after Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks, we hooked up with Bob Dylan, and they booed us all over the world.
Well, yeah, let's drill down on that. Ruby was the mobster who owned the strip club, who shot what's his name? The guy who shot Kennedy.
Right.
Sorry, it's got a lot of names floating around my head. But going out, the part of the film where you went out with Dylan, and Dylan had real hardcore folk music following, and you guys were going to start plugging into amps and doing electric stuff, and I guess it freaked out or pissed off his fans, or how do you explain that?
Yeah, it was purist, folk music purist, I guess, that didn't want any change. And he had grown to a place, you know, that he had achieved something, and he wanted to achieve more, which is, you know, a good thing usually. But when he did this, it was really a tremendous outcry against him making this move. And we were a rock and roll band. We didn't know much about folk music or even that much about him.
Mm-hmm.
And so we walked into the fire without knowing how hot it was in there. And the idea of playing all over North America, all over Europe, all over Australia, and every night you go out there and people boo you and sometimes throw stuff at you. And so what it does is it thickens the skin, and it also tells you that you're part of a musical revolution and you might be the real thing.
Well, you do have to, I'll tell you, sometimes when I'm doing stand-up and it's like it's not going that well, or the audience isn't responding like you'd like them to respond, those are the times where you do have to really dig deep and sort of focus. You know, like when everyone's laughing and having a good time, it's so much easier. But when they're not laughing and it's not flowing, those are the times when you really kind of have to be tight. As a band, as a stand-up, like that's there's no room for error at this point. I don't know. Did you guys have that feeling, like Huey Lewis was saying he'd get booed too. They're opening for like the Doobie Brothers or something, and they got tight because they just go right to the next song, like boom, 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 like here we go.
Yeah.
Did you guys react that way, or what did it do playing in front of that hostile crowd?
Well, we were uptight in the beginning because I'd never heard of anything like this. In history.
Were they booing you guys because you were electric?
Yeah. And
then later they would boo Dylan for doing half a set electric.
They were booing both of us. And in this process, we just kept getting better. And finally, after a while, we were just playing to one another. And mm-hmm. we were getting better and better, and we knew it. And we thought, it's us against the world here. And we knew, you know, there were times after the show, nobody wanted to hang out with us after you get booed all night. So we'd go back to the hotel, and sometimes we would listen to a tape that they made of the show we did that night. And I can distinctly remember saying to Bob and saying to the other guys, they're wrong. Mm-hmm. This is really good. They're wrong. And the fact that in time it proved that we were losing the battle, but we won the war. Because eventually it was received like this changed the course of music forever.
So many questions. One, when Dylan would go out there, he'd do half an acoustic set and then half an electric set, but he was getting all the boos. Was there discussion about getting someone else to open, getting Peter, Paul, and Mary to open for him instead of the band? Was there discussions about changing up the set or him not plugging in? I mean, why no alterations? I feel like if you just went out and got booed the first night, the next night you'd be like, all right, we got to change it up.
No, there was no discussions about it. And it was what it was. And like I said, we were honing our skills and we were getting so we were doing this better and better. And as time went on, we thought we could feel that this revolution is a powerful thing. We actually understood that not in the beginning, but at a certain point we did. And we would play a show some nights. People were booing fiercely. And we'd come off the stage and Bob would say, I think that went pretty well.
And he meant it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No. And you're right. Usually you would be playing and if it's not going over with the audience, like you're talking about, you know, doing comedy and you'd say, oh, that didn't work. There wasn't a budge of anything. It was, this is what it is. And when we played together, some dynamic thing happened. It was explosive and it was fierce and it was violent even in the musicality. And we were getting off on it. And so we just had to just shut everybody off. And, you know, I made a joke at the time that I learned to play without looking at my fingers on the neck because I was ducking things people were throwing, you know, but we adjusted to it.
How did you guys universally and Bob Dylan land on that? Because, you know, in retrospect, I guess everything worked out, but I think most human beings, whatever they did for a living, but especially music or comedy or whatever, would start altering their material. They just, right. As somebody in the group would raise their hand and go, hey man, we gotta cover a Beatles song. I'm tired of getting shit thrown at us. Like somebody's got to.
No.
There's a Paul Revere and the Raiders song we should cover. It's snappy. You know what I mean? It's finger popping music. Like nobody caved.
Here's the thing, and it might sound a little bit, but we were a really good band. He hired us because everybody around knew we were really, really good at what we did. And he was really, really good at what he did. And when you put that things together, it's, you know, you start thinking, whoa, one and one makes three here.
Right.
It doesn't make.
Did the tour come around? Did the audience come around eventually, you know, stop 31 of the tour?
No.
They never came around.
Never came around. But a lot of, you know, you mentioned the Beatles, but the Beatles came and, you know, to hear us play a couple of times, and they were like, don't listen to them. This is really good. And a lot of other musicians and writers and some people that kind of, they got the joke.
Right.
You know, and we adjusted to the altitude.
How did a group that was this self-assured and this strong and this seasoned, how did it come apart? How did it come undone? Was it, you think the fact that there was that kind of tight, I don't mean tightness, but I mean
closeness,
the kind of closeness, like in a family with the brother and sister having talked for 12 years or something, you know, like, you know, when you have casual relationships with people, you don't have explosive endings.
You know, we grew up together. I started playing with Levon when I was 16 years old. And then over the period of the next couple of years, the rest of the guys that went on to become the band, we were set. And what we thought, each guy here plays a really, really important part in what we do. And when we played with Bob Dylan, that was just a sideline. That was a detour in what we were going to do. But it turned out to be a historic detour and a fantastic experience because he was great and he was a great guy and we all went something. We went somewhere together. We went into a storm and we came out alive. And it was a great feeling about that. And then when the band made their first record, it didn't resemble what we did with Ronnie Hawkins or as the Hawks or what we did with Bob Dylan. It was a completely different sound, a different flavor. And it was just our evolution. And so in this musical journey, when we were first together, we were just some guys, you know, hanging tight, you know.
Right.
And then over time, you know, you grow up. And some people get married. Some people move over here. Some people move over there. It doesn't stay the same.
What year did the first album come out?
68.
68. And you guys sort of did the farewell tour in 76, 77?
Yeah. The movie came out in 78.
78.
The beginning right. of 78. Yeah.
So less, I mean, from the album, from the first album to when you guys broke up. 8 or 9 years, something like that. Scorsese, how does he fit into this mix?
I asked him if he would direct the movie of this event that we were going to have to bring this part of our journey to a conclusion. And I could sense that in his films, he had a musical instinct. There was something that he knew that I didn't recognize in other people. And I was a movie bug. And I thought I knew what I was talking about. And in going to him and convincing him to do this, I realized I did know what I was talking about. And he made this extraordinary movie from this event, a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
Yeah, as I think about Goodfellas and I think about the music and like Goodfellas, all perfect needle drops for what was going on, that Clapton song, Layla and everything like that.
Yeah.
But then you also went on to work with Scorsese, right?
And I started after The Last Waltz, his next movie, I worked on the music for Raging Bull, it was called.
Sure.
I mean, what, you know, and it got me hooked. I felt the power of music and film becoming one thing. And he said that all along. He said the music and what's on the screen, they're the same thing. They're all part of the same thing. And when you get it right, one really, really complements the other. And of course we know that music makes movies more exciting, but Raging Bull was a different animal. It was a different musical experience. It was incredible. And so anyway, with that feeling.
It's a lot of classical, right?
Well, there's this Mascagni music in it that was taken, and I tried to find better versions of it, but there was a recording of called Welcome to Italy from this little orchestra from Bologna,
mm-hmm.
and it was like a tourist recording. And I went through Leonard Bernstein, through his version of the Mascagni music, he was the composer, and many other people, and none of them had the emotional effect of this little orchestra from Bologna, and it just ripped your heart right out of your chest.
Well, it was your ear, though, that was able to pinpoint that. Like, probably people with a lesser ear would have just got the cleanest recording or the nicest recording. You know, I mean, that's where you come in, right? I mean, that's your ear.
I had to do a lot of fixing on it. I had to do a lot of, you know, figuring out technically how to make this a little sound more beautiful, because the recording wasn't that great. And even in the recording, somebody bumped up against the tape machine when they were recording, and the whole orchestra dips for a second, it comes back up, and I had to figure out how to undo that. And at the time, it was pretty tricky.
Yeah, but anyway, no digital.
That experience with him was so incredible that I went on, and after that, I did the music for A King of Comedy and on and on. And I think we've worked together on about 10 movies now. And I just did the score for The Irishman.
Amazing. So you're in Canada, and your mom is American Indian, or not American, North American Indian. Your dad and her get divorced at about 11 or 12.
12 or 13.
You then find out it's not your biological dad that's hitting you and your mom. So do you have more history with him after that, or do you?
I saw him more after that. Every once in a while, he would come and visit me at a club I would be playing with Ronnie Hawkins. But I got really, really taken in from my new family, from the family. And as it turned out, my father, my blood father, they just adored him. And that I was the remnants of that or something. They brought me into their world so whole.
So you never met any of those people before?
No.
It wasn't people being introduced as some aunt something or anything. It was just none of those people were in your world.
My mother had a fear of that family. That they would just come and take me away.
Mm-hmm.
So she really kind of disappeared
uh-huh.
in the Toronto Indian country world for her own, for our protection. But when I did come into their world, they were incredible people. But as time went on, I realized that my uncle was a major underground figure, and he was part connected. He was connected in the mafia, and he turned out to be kind of the Mayor Lansky of Canada.
Wow. And it was his brother that was your biological dad that was killed changing the flat tire on the side of the highway.
And he would always say to me, "I'm only doing what your dad would have done."
Wow. And they were Jewish.
Yeah.
And now you're playing. What kind of student are you?
In school, I was just there. I was just doing what you got to do. But by the time I got to a place that music had really gotten under my skin, I was 13 years old. I find out who my real father is. I'm standing there at the crossroads. I already play guitar that my relatives on the Indian Reserve have taught me. Rock and roll comes bursting out of from nowhere. Nobody saw this coming. All of a sudden, rock and roll, and I'm like, oh, there's a connection here. And I've just reached puberty. Hello? That was it. I was gone. I went in that direction. It was a magnet. And And that was my story. My relatives, though, were like, are you sure about this rock and roll thing? You know, it's like, isn't it a bunch of crazy people doing crazy stuff? And then they were like, oh, you mean show business? Jewish.
Sure.
You know, they're like, of course, now we understand.
So this, what year would this be about?
1958, 59.
So rock and roll's just getting started, and it's you're vibing on it incredibly. Are you going to go on and finish high school, or is it all just sort of understood that this is what you're doing? Or do you just sleepwalk through high school and then start pursuing it?
Yeah, I was very much distracted by this possibility. And music came in like an addiction. I just couldn't undo it. I couldn't turn my back for a minute. So I was going to school. I was doing what you do. But I was telling everybody, you know, one day I'm going to go out in the world. I'm going to go everywhere, and I'm going to write music, and I'm going to play music, and I'm going to do something really special. And everybody was like, take an aspirin and call me in the morning. That I have a song on my new album, my last album, Cinematic, called Dead End Kid. And it talks about this, that nobody believed it. And because in my background, my mom's, you know, relatives and everything, and now my family and everything, they were like, you're probably going to just end up in prison. That's what happens to guys like you. And I was like, no, don't you see? Don't you see what's going to happen here? And I could see it. Nobody else could. And then when I was 16, Ronnie Hawkins, who was a big rockabilly star at the time, brought me down to Arkansas. I went down to the Mississippi Delta. This is where this music grew out of the ground, and it was like so thrilling. So I went down there to, and it was an impossible feat because I was 16 years old. I was too young to play in the places that they played. I wasn't experienced enough. I wasn't a good enough guitar player. And there's no Canadians in southern rock and roll bands. That's almost against the rules.
Why did he bring you? What did he see in you?
I had written a couple of songs that he recorded when I was 15. And he just thought, he used to say, I think you got potential.
And I tried
really hard to prove him right. And in the movie, Once We're Brothers, there's a whole point where he's talking and he's saying, boy, I found out nobody's going to work harder, and he's got the talent. And if he works that hard, he could turn out to be something.
The self-belief, where did that stem from? I mean, or whatever we're calling it. You knew it was going to work out.
Blindness. You know, it was like blind faith, I guess. But when you've got enough talent, enough of a gift, that everybody around is saying, whoa, that's pretty good. And then someone else says, no, that's really good. And then someone says, you know what? You're great. You start believing it.
Well, you must have taken to the guitar quickly and shown a lot of potential and talent early. So then you got that feedback.
I was on a mission, and there was nothing going to get in the way of that.
But still, you know, as I think about, I always kind of try to compare and contrast young comedy to young musicians, you know, and when you're young, 15-year-old sort of comedian, you don't really get any positive feedback. You're told to shut up and sit down because all you're doing is distracting people, and your jokes suck. You know, you're 15. You have no life experience. Why should any? You know, no one ever goes, write that down. That's awesome. You're going to be the next George Carlin. They just go, sit down, shut up. But if you did play the guitar pretty well at 15, people would go, well, that's something. And I guess you got some of that.
I got some of that, and at 16, I was playing better. And by the time I was 17, there was a lot of guitar players trying to do what I was doing.
So this is a, I mean, this is a, I don't call it a gift, but a gift, virtuoso style. I mean, there's most guys can't master an instrument at even if you're not saying master, but at 17, you just don't master things that way.
You know, it was a force. You know, now that I could look back and I'd say, and I could ask what you're asking, like, what happened there? How did this come to be like that? And when I look back on it now, I just see, wow, I had just blinders on. All I could see was where I needed to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on that path.
Did you ever graduate high school?
No. No, but what I did was, when I was down south all of that time, I felt this hunger to feed my mind, and I became a book nerd. I read day, and when I wasn't practicing, I was reading, and I was gathering, and I was informing myself, and I read so many books, and then I evolved to reading movie scripts. I found a place in New York, Gotham Book Mart, on 47th Street that sold movie scripts, because I was a movie bug, and I could find out, how did they do that? Where does that come from? These ideas, this imagination. So I started reading lots and lots of these scripts that you could buy there, and that became my literature then. And so it took me somewhere. It helped, you know, this need for information.
Well, I'm replaying some of your songs in my head, and there's real storytelling going on. And most songs are, you know, they're about a girl or they're about something. But the story, as I picture the band and a lot of your songs, I'm kind of, you're seeing the story. Feels like you're reading a novel. And I guess that's the connection. That's how you think, or that's what you're attracted to, or that's what you read. And then reading, how much did reading, so reading a script, I guess, a song's 3 minutes and a movie's 90 minutes or 110 minutes or whatever it is, but it's still a little story with condensed within this little package. Is that something you were consciously doing, or do you think that's just what you were attracted to and you didn't know it?
I think that my writing was directly influenced by storytelling. Also that I first heard on the Six Nation, hearing these elders tell stories, it just sent chills down my spine. And I told my mom when I was 8 years old, I said, you know, when I grow up one day, I want to be a storyteller. And she said, oh, I'm sure you will.
Right.
You know, it was like a mom's encouragement. But I was hooked on storytelling. And then I was hooked on movies. And so the songs that I was writing, I looked at them like movies. I looked at them like stories. And I wasn't drawn to writing, she used to love me, but she doesn't love me anymore.
Right.
So I don't like you.
Right.
I wasn't drawn to that. I wanted to paint pictures. I wanted to do all of that.
Yeah. I'm glad that we're talking about it, because listening to band songs, and again, you know, Huey Lewis was in here and he's singing about being hip to be square, and it's not really telling a story about anything in particular. Great guy in the world, greatest guy in the world, but it's not, I'm not, as I'm driving my car hearing it, I'm not picturing the location and where we are and who we're dealing with and all the stories. I like John Hiatt, because John Hiatt's a guy who kind of tells stories when he's singing his songs. You're picturing what's going on, but I never really got that connection, the theatrical connection, but now it makes perfect sense. You're not reading crime novels, you're reading scripts, and then you're telling the story, condensing it down. And that's the way your mind works. That's the direction it works. Can you think of, I'll tease this because I have to do a spot. Can you think of some scripts that you read that we would have heard of that you either thought, this is the best script I've ever read, or, God, the script wasn't that good, but I saw the movie and it was killer. Like, do you have any of those? You must have read all those scripts. You must have a few examples of those. Tease it. Hold on one sec. So, what years would this have been?
This is 1967.
Okay, so we'll have some scripts from the earlier days or later where you just read the script and you went, this is the best thing I ever heard, and maybe the movie wasn't that great, or vice versa. All right, first let me tell you about 8sleep.com. I got my 8sleep bed set up, and it is so good. Research shows just how important sleep is to energy, physical performance, overall health. Sleep is fitness. If you toss and turn, you may be too hot, you may be too cold. Sleeping, your ideal temperature, helps you sleep longer. When you get better sleep, you get better focus and better concentration, better everything. The Pod by 8sleep automatically adjusts temperatures for the best, most comfortable sleep. Even has thermal alarm. We're just talking about this in the news. You don't get jarred awake. It starts slowly warming your bed or slowly cooling your bed, and it wakes you up naturally. 94% of people who sleep on the Pod sleep better. And right now, you get $150 off and free shipping at 8sleep.com/Adam. That's E-I-G-H-T, sleep.com/Adam. Do yourself a favor. Invest in yourself. You will not regret it. Scripts, any come to mind?
Oh, many, many come to mind. And there was two worlds in this. There was the classic movies by Howard Hawks and Orson Welles and John Ford and all these great American directors. And then what was really baffling me, when I would see a movie by Kurosawa, and it was this historic stuff and the style of it, and then seeing Fellini's 8½, I think, how in the world do they put these pieces together? Where does this come from? What's the source of it? And then you realize the source is always in the writing. It always comes from that place. So I have a deeper respect for this, and it ended up in really inspiring the book that I wrote, Testimony, that the documentary Once Were Brothers is based on. But back then, when I would read Persona by Ingmar Bergman, I thought, how in the world do you get that feeling across? And when I would read these scripts, I would go, wow, that's it. When I read the script for Double Indemnity, I thought, I see, I understand this thing. I didn't understand it before. Now I'm plugged in to storytelling on a deeper level.
Yeah, it's very interesting because I'm always thinking about the sports analogy where they go, well, famous wide out for the Pittsburgh Steelers, Lynn Swann, studied ballet as a youth, I guess as a young person, and they made fun of him, of course. But when you see him make some of these catches, they look like ballet moves. He did things that other people didn't do, and that was ballet, which couldn't get any further from football, but yet it aided him, And the notion of reading these scripts all day, which didn't really seem to have a lot to do with rock and roll music, that aided you. That was your sort of what ballet was to Lynn Swann, scripts were to Robbie Robertson in his music making.
Absolutely. It was a direct connection. And I would read a script and I would write a song, and the song could have nothing whatsoever to do with that script, but it was definitely the spark.
Well, I think this is a good time to explain how important your version of ballet or script reading is, whoever's listening. Meaning, there's a lot of people that like, I like rock and roll music, so I'm just going to listen to more rock and roll music. Or I like football, so I'm going to watch more football. they triple down on everything. But expand it a little, get away from it, and it'll probably make your game better when you come back to the game.
I think there's a big part of this. And it's been that way in music ever since I can remember, and still with the music that I make right now, and even with the film work with Martin Scorsese, it is trying to avoid the obvious and embrace the unexpected. It's just a very basic, you know, thing that I've got that I thought, well, if everybody's doing that, I don't need to do that. I need to go, you know, I need to find my own way of doing something. So that was the inspiration, to not just get caught up in what's trendy or what's obvious.
So the band has this cosmic connection, which then makes the product that much better, that much more superior, which is why you get the Beatles and Bob Dylan and those guys who are, you know, pretty handy around a recording studio and a stage. They're even the people who know music the best are attracted to the band, which has to be supremely flattering. But because of the very tight-knit reality of the relationship, when it comes undone, it starts coming undone with more ferocity than a casual relationship would. Can we talk about that?
Yeah,
phase?
And you started to ask that before, and I drifted off in a different direction.
It's all right,
but what in the period of time that we were together up to the last waltz, we were always tight knit. We were always on the same wavelength. After the last waltz, the idea was that everybody was going to go and do something for their own individual pleasure, follow their bliss, whatever, right? And then we were going to reconvene and be fresh, and we wouldn't have been on the road all of our lives. Something new would be in the air, and we were going to make more music better than we ever had. That was my dream. That was what we wanted in. And after the last waltz, I was happy to see the guys going off, some of them making solo records, some of them doing this or that. And after a period of time of me asking, when do you want to catch up? When do you want to, you know, get back together and do some work? And for a while, it was like, well, I just got to finish doing this, or there was, you know, reasons behind that. And after a while, we were going to meet up, and we were going to meet up at this place, this clubhouse, this place that we had out in Malibu. And I went there, and I was waiting for the guys, and nobody showed up. And I thought,
what year is this? Sorry.
This is now probably 1970, late 78, early 79, something like that.
So it's been a couple of years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just for everybody to do their own thing. So when this happened, I sat there, and then finally it started to get dark outside. And I thought, I know I don't want to, but I have to accept the reality here. And everybody forgot to come back. And I just had to accept that. And then after some years passed, there was never any, you know, big differences and everything. And then some people fell into kind of some hard times. Things weren't working out as well. And then it kind of became my fault that, because what I was doing was working okay. And, you know, how that goes, and with a brotherhood that was so close. And when it just kind of splinters off in that, and then you realize it isn't coming back, there's a deep sadness in that too. And I wanted it to work, but it didn't. And I had to just learn to accept that.
So, no, did you physically talk to people on the phone for the sort of return to the Malibu clubhouse?
Yeah. I spoke to people. I saw over the years, I saw the guys, and everybody was just, at that time, was really like, yeah, I know, we just, you know, I just got caught up in doing this stuff. And
was everyone very financially comfortable then?
It was starting to change, and I was working. I was doing stuff. I was, like I said, I had done this movie Carney, and then I was doing Raging Bull, and then I was doing The King of Comedy, and then I was making a solo record, and I had a lot of stuff stirring around, and because I just did, you know, it's the way, you know,
Did the band ever come back together?
Well, the guys got, they called me and they said, we're going to go out and play some dates.
What year is this?
This is years later, like in 83 or mm-hmm. I can't remember exactly when it was. And I said, if you want to get together and create something and do some great music and, you know, I'm really into that. I don't want to go back out on the road. We did that. We played every place possible on the planet, and we played the worst places and the best place and the biggest places and the smallest places. We made a movie called The Last Waltz that's really saying we're going to step aside from this thing. And it was really my thoughts at the time, because during that period, it was very experimental with drugs and alcohol. And people were getting caught up in it. It was doing damage. And I thought, whoa, let's get out of the way. And that's part of what The Last Waltz was, too. And so I was making a comment in this because a lot of our really close friends had died. You know,
overdose and things.
Yeah, on the road and everything. I thought, whoa, let's get out of the way here. Let's figure out how to go to a different chapter, take care of ourselves. Let's do something positive. And then when they said, we're going to go back out on the road, I got a very uneasy feeling because in the beginning, I said, if we don't get out of the way, somebody's going to get hurt. Somebody's going to die. And they went out on the road, and somebody died.
Who died?
Richard Manuel. He died. And then Rick Danko died. And then Levon Helm died.
Was this all alcohol, drug-related?
No, it was just life-related.
You're sorry. I watched the trailer for Once We're Brothers. I got the link 11 this morning. I had to leave my house at 11:30, so I couldn't. I'm going to watch the movie later, but I watched a trailer and I've seen The Last Waltz, but I didn't see this. So I'm asking these questions.
Yeah, a lot of this is addressed in a very soulful way in this movie, and that's one of the reasons that I'm very proud of what they did.
Did you? It must have felt like you were wanting to take this sabbatical and then come back on a sort of creative plane. And they basically took the sabbatical. And then at some point when they needed more money, we're just going to go out and tour, which felt like that wasn't the original purpose of the sabbatical. And it also felt like a little sellout to you. I mean, it didn't feel like the right thing to do. Obviously, they were going out to go get paid. And when you said, let's get together in Malibu, that wasn't a payday. Or maybe they didn't need money at that point or whatever. So nobody right. showed up to that. Then later on, people go through their money or they get divorced or they have whatever. And then they go, all right, let's get the band back together so we can go get paid. But you wanted to get back together to create. And they got back together to get paid. And it probably rubbed you the wrong way.
It didn't rub me the wrong way. I thought that's not an exciting direction to me. That's not even challenging. I know that. I know what it means to go play some gigs.
Right.
You know, and I know that that's part of
the. And play the songs you've been playing the whole time.
Yeah. And I thought, I don't want to be in The King and I for the rest of my life.
Right.
You know, I don't want to be Yul Brynner doing The King and I 50 years later. Now, some people do that and they do it really well. And I have great respect for that.
But I
just have a different calling. That's all.
It's the opposite of people. people, I've always say this, but I do think it's true. There's good things. Being in show business or being creative is a good thing. You get paid a lot, and one of the things that sucks when you have a monotonous factory job, you have to go to the same factory and do the same thing. And so what if somebody said, well, you can go to the GM factory in Van Nuys and stamp out fenders for Camaros for 40 years, but I'll pay you $10 million a year. Well, you'd be rich, but you'd still have a monotonous, shitty job that wasn't that exciting to you, that you could kind of sleepwalk through. And there's an element of show business that can be that way, where you just take a residency at in Vegas, or you do a long term something, and it's show business, and it's a good payday,
and some people do it really well. Some people are on that path, and they go out and they entertain brilliantly, but I'm
right.
For me, I'm more about the Notebook. I'm more about the writing. I'm more about the storytelling. I'm more about the sound. I'm more about the creative factor. That's what excites me. That's where I get chills.
Did anyone else in the band share that with you after you guys broke up?
No.
It's strange that a group that was so talented and so progressive and so strong and so tightly knit and stuff, that there wasn't more of more versions of you in that band, like more folks that had that mindset or had a head on it like you did.
Everybody in the band played an incredibly important part. But I learned early on that part of my responsibility, my job in this, was to figure out the direction, was to figure out the story, was to write the songs, was to have progressive ideas. And other guys did other stuff that was so extraordinary. And I'm so thankful for their incredible talent and their brotherhood and fantastic characters. But everybody does something different. And it was like I found out, even from watching those movies and everything, that with the different guys in the band, when it came time for us to do something creative, like make a record or a movie or whatever, my job was casting. I would cast this guy to sing that song because I knew his instrument so well and I knew he could kill it. Mm-hmm. And I would cast this guy to come in and do the high part in this section here because I knew what they could do so well. And it wasn't like, these guys were just doing what I said. Everybody contributed from the bottom up. But it was my job to figure out these things. And from reading those scripts and watching these movies and everything, it became a bit like a workshop. And
yeah.
Like you said earlier, a theatrical setup.
Well, you were directing.
That was my job. And because I was always watching these films, I'm sure it rubbed off on me a little bit.
Well, it is interesting. You think about Tarantino and he's going to do Pulp Fiction and he decides John Travolta is going to be the lead. And John Travolta is a pretty unlikely character to be the lead in that type of movie at that point in John Travolta's career. But of course, Tarantino, being the director that he is, saw something.
Imagination.
And that was sort of what you were doing when you were saying, you sing the lead on this one, or you play this part, or you do that part. It's a sort of, that's what you have to have in that position.
But a lot of times, in a John Ford movie, they're the same people in the movie, only they're playing different parts in this one.
Right.
And in Ingmar Bergman's movies, he uses the same people in a lot of his movies. And now this time you play the guy who owns the house. You play the distraught wife. And they... So he knew what they could do really well, and he put them in the right place at the right time. And, you know, and Marty as well, you know, in a lot of these movies, with Joe Pesci and De Niro,
sure, yeah.
And, you
crazy.
Know, and
yeah.
Harvey Keitel and everybody, you know, just knowing their instruments so well.
Well, you know, it's weird. I've never thought about interviewing people and doing that thing like Barbara Walters or something where I ask the person the same questions I asked the person who was in here before. But I'm now thinking about it, and I'm thinking about it with you, so I'm going to ask you. I was telling this
you're,
to...
No, wait. You're not going to make me cry.
No.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you the question that... I asked John Cleese, and it really made him think about it, and he really said, that's an excellent question. So I said, are you funny or are you smart? Like, which one's first, you know? And now I have to ask you, is it the music or is it the brain? The smarts, the creativity, you know? Can you separate them a little? I mean, you have this, there are plenty of guys, you know, Eddie Van Halen is great with the guitar. I don't know how inquisitive he is. I don't know if he's on a journey. Like you are. That doesn't mean you can't really master an instrument or even write a song, but you have a kind of an intelligence, a curiosity, and a motor to pursue those curiosities. You've probably always been that way, but what are you first? Are you a musician first, or is it smart or musician? Now, John Cleese like had a little trouble. Like he's like, yeah, I don't know. It's a good question because he's a brilliant guy who's amazing sense of humor, gift sense of humor. How do you think of yourself?
I think of it as all of the above, but I do believe that I was born this way. I do believe that something drove me to pursue it stronger and to discover. I'm just so curious.
Curious.
I'm just on a discovery mission in life, and I wake up in the morning and I think, oh God, I'm going to work on this today, and I'm going to figure out that thing. I know I don't know the answer to what I have to figure out, but I'm going to go in there and I'm going to scramble around in the dark until I find the light, you know, and it just excites me. And that's the part of the brain, I guess that is. But my fingers work pretty good on the guitar still. But it is, all of this stuff are just different tools. And I love exercising them.
Do you feel you were in an analog era where you'd have to go down to the bookstore in Manhattan and get the scripts, physical, tangible scripts? Now you can flip open a computer, look at your phone, and find everything out. Do you find your curiosity getting sucked into that vortex a little bit? Because the bookstore closes, or it's not open on Sunday, or whatever that is. You know what I mean? Now there's a hole you can go down on the computer, and you can spend endless amounts of time satisfying your curiosity. How do you negotiate that?
I just get out my Kindle and read that book, and it saves me the time of having to go to the store and find it, to go scrambling around. You know, you used to be, I go to this store and they say, no, we're sold out now. And I think, oh God, you know, and I've wasted that time. Now I don't have as much time left, so I can't afford to waste any of it.
But you find yourself going on to these deep dives. Like I was on the internet, and I was probably looking at some stuff for you, and somehow I got onto John Denver and Mama Cass Elliott, and then I realized Mama Cass Elliott was married to a guy named Jim Hendrix, but it wasn't Jimi Hendrix, it was like the folk singer Jim Hendrix, and Jim Hendrix is 80 and still alive, and I was just like, God, the guy who was married to Mama Cass Elliott is still alive, and his name is Jim Hendrix, but not Jimi Hendrix, and I just kept going down this, trying to, I don't know, connect dots that never needed to be connected.
Oh, the truth is so curious.
Oh,
when
my
you find
God.
These things that you say, I can't believe this. And I don't know. However you find it is exciting to me. And in some of these things, like we're saying, God, I would have never known that. I could have never found that. And there's some things where I wouldn't have cared. you know, but now I do care. So anyway, it plays tricks on you, but hopefully, you know, one learns to use it to their advantage.
The doc is called Once We're Brothers. It's Robbie Robertson and the band. It's in select theaters starting on Friday. The trailer's amazing, and I'm going to go watch the full doc as soon as I get home and get a little bit of more time. Scorsese's in here, she's a producer. Brian Grazer, Ron Howard. Boy, I'll tell you, man, could do an hour on Brian Grazer and how curious that guy is.
Yeah.
He sat right where you are sitting, and he just started telling me how curious he was about it. That's what led him to everything. And I thought, God help you if you're not curious, man. I don't know how to teach it. I don't know how to infuse it. I don't know how we can give you a shot of it when you're 5 years old, but if you're curious, you're going to succeed. And if you're not curious, it's going to be a long and pretty boring life, but you might not be aware of it.
Yeah, see, that's the tricky thing. Some people just aren't really born curious. And you can feed your mind and you could develop something that you think, oh my God, I've got to find out more about that. You know, but if it's not a broad horizon where you think there's so little time and there's so much that I enjoy and I want to know about and I want to embrace. And for me, it's a lot of stuff that I want to use in my work.
Sure.
And so I need it.
I got to tell you, I don't know how you get curious, but please, people, start getting curious. And last but not least, I'll tell you about Geico. Do you own, do you rent your home? Well, you probably have one or the other, either own or you rent. You want to do a little bundling of the policies? Good. Do it at Geico. It makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too. You have so much to do. So go to Geico. Save some time. Get a quote. Go to geico.com and see just how much you could be saving today on your homeowners, auto insurance, and all that renters. Bundle it all, geico.com. Robbie, where did the hour plus go? This has been fast.
Jeez, I'm telling you, this Adam Carolla of Glendale, he'll get you talking, I'll tell you.
Well, I've been a fan of yours for a long time, so I've been looking forward to this for a while. And you can go, by the way, if you want to check out Robbie's website, it's robbie-robertson.com. And I guess if you go there, we can find out all the links to all the everything that is Robbie Robertson.
Stuff.
So if you're curious, go look. Till next time, Adam Carolla for Robbie Robertson saying mahalo.
The Carolla Drinks Wine Club has arrived. We're bringing you all the bottles you can drink. And more perks than you know what to do with. For those who just want to dip their toes into the wine club, our 3 and 6 pack clubs will get you 3 shipments a year, 10% off all wine orders, and a DVD of the long-awaited Uppity, plus more and more goodies throughout the year. For those who want to dive in head first, our Case Club will get you 3 shipments a year, 10% off all wine orders, a DVD of Uppity, and 2 tickets to the Carolla Family Barbecue, featuring the entire ACS family, a lineup of comedians, all the food and booze you can consume, a photo with Adam, Bald, and Gina in the ACS studio, and a private concert from The Offspring. But wait, there's more. For renewing Case Club members only, you'll get a private tequila and cigar tasting with the unholy trinity of Adam, Drew, and Garrigus before the barbecue even begins. For those who want to attend the party of the year without having delicious booze sent to your door 3 times a year, tickets are available for sale at CorollaDrinks.com. So prep your livers. The Carolla Drinks Wine Club is back.
Ace and Shecky, let's do it. Good sport.
The Podcast One Sports Network presents Good Sports.
Hi and hello, sports fans. Welcome to a brand new episode of Good Sports, sure to be filled with some hot sports talk for you. Dave Damashek here, Adam Carolla over there. Ace, with your permission, I'd like to try a new little mini segment within this segment that's called Good Sports.
Granted.
Excellent. Well, first you should hear what it is. It's called Caroli Locks.
Mm.
And what I want you to do, much like you know, she had to do. Wait, was it the Bears who did like the too warm, too cold,
the
just
porridge,
right?
Yeah,
the porridge. Was it she that was doing the evaluating, or was it the Bears? It was she, right?
She went to the Bears' home. The Bears were gone. She tried the porridge. One was too cold. One was too hot. One was just right. I don't know. First off, what kind of porridge schedule is this? Don't you make porridge at one time? You make one pot of porridge. You don't make three separate
pots of porridge. I don't know. I've never had porridge.
Well, let's break down the game film, David. You think I've ever waltzed in my kitchen and said, all right, here's what I need. I need porridge at 8 a.m.
Right.
I need porridge at 9:30. And then another pot of porridge around noon.
That was the brunch porridge. Don't eat that.
Leave it out.
It's time for late lunch.
Why all so different? They're all in the same bowl and the same amount of porridge.
Very strange.
Why was one cold, one hot, and one just right?
It was from the batch yesterday that they put in the fridge, and like maybe Mama Bear won't notice, but you know, or
I think she broke in, she ate the porridge, and then why are the Bears leaving before eating their porridge? And then she came, then I think she went to go sleep in their bed.
Presumptuous.
And then I think one bed may have been too soft or too firm.
How comfortable can you be breaking into somebody's home and find, like, they were just here, witness the hot porridge that they left behind. They could be back any minute, but I need a nap.
Yeah.
That seems like that seems awfully secure, too secure, perhaps.
And I think, and the beds, how much range in a bed would bears have? You think they'd have find out what Goldilocks' sleep number is, Gary.
I was just going to say, if she maybe, like the Bears had one of those kind of deals, like the, oh, he likes it firm kind of thing.
Did she sleep in all their beds? Didn't she make that proclamation about their beds as well?
I'm still reading. I believe they did, but I have discovered the reason they left. Their porridge was too hot, so they decided to take a walk in the forest to let it cool.
Yeah, but they also found it too cold.
No, she found
She found
it.
What? No, this one's too hot, this one's too cold, this one's just right.
Yeah, they would cool at the same rate. This is a wildly unrealistic portrayal of what goes on in the forest.
All right, so we're now 3 minutes in to the new segment that is called Corollilocks. And in our world of hot takes, you know, in sports, I feel like you are the perfect guy to evaluate whether or not our opinions about sports and the game of life are we overreacting? Are we underrating, overrating this, that sort of thing? So let's get into it here. And I'll start with something close to our mutual heart, which is Kevin Hench. And Kevin Hench and I argue on text message and otherwise. Me, him, Sal, and Simmons have, through every football season, an ongoing text conversation. And Hench decided recently something with the NFL providing the, you know, the 100th year best players ever. And Jim Brown is, you know, the running back. And I feel like how much can you get excited about Jim Brown? None of us saw him play. How much? And he's like, Jim Brown's the best. And Hench and Simmons will argue about Bobby Orr. Bobby Orr's the greatest hockey player of all time. Don't bring up Lemieux over Gretzky because Orr's better than both of them. I'm like, that's a great point, except you never saw Bobby Orr play. How much do you know about him? What do you think about Jim Brown and people who argue for him?
I was impressed that in around the same conversation, you successfully named every defensive MVP of the Super Bowl, I do believe, for every Super Bowl
played. I did. I reeled them all off. I think there were 10 or 11 of them
super
in
impressive,
Super Bowl history.
And was naming the MVPs on the offensive side of the ball as he went through Rolodex.
Thank you for
noticing impressive.
That.
Very impressive. Number one.
Chuck Halley was the first one.
Number two.
Only guy to win one on a losing
game. I'm not a fan of going through. I'm not a fan of the go-to names for anything. I don't really like it for, you know, I don't know. If someone said, who's your favorite president? Someone said John Kennedy. I just go, I don't know. Dig a little deeper. I like deeper cuts. You know,
I hear
Jim Brown
yes.
is just a go-to. It's a go-to. No one will ever push back on you. He was a phenomenon. And, you know, it was a boy playing, a man playing with boys and all that kind of stuff. And I do agree that he was a dominant player and that, you know, everyone says he could have played in any era and all that, that kind of stuff. In a weird way, if you were to say to me, what highlight reel would you like to watch? Would you like to watch Jim Brown's highlight reel or would you like to watch Earl Campbell's highlight reel? I'd rather watch Earl Campbell's highlight reel. Now, it was in color and I was there, never at a game, obviously, but I was sitting in front of a TV set. And one first thing that would come up then on that tape would be him running over my beloved Isaiah Robinson for the Los Angeles Rams.
Yeah.
But, you know, Jim Brown is great. And I guess the answer is then who do we put above Jim Brown? But I agree, a little uninspired, a little lazy. It was funny. I was... I don't want to say this to Hench, but I'll just say it to Hench anyway. I was watching Last Man Standing. It was like a rerun of like Last Man Standing. And there was a joke that I'm sure Hench didn't write. But there's this joke where Tim Allen's sitting there and his wife is saying, like, I'm going to run for district selectman, but I need a campaign manager. But I need someone who knows me well, and I need someone who's fast on their feet, and I need someone who's quick-witted and likable. And of course, you know where the joke is going. And then he's like, well, I guess I could carve out. That's why I'm going with Sheila, you know, and she comes through the door. And you knew where this was.
Sure.
You knew where this one was going to end up, right? That's kind of the way I feel about Jim Brown. I know where this is going.
It was a little ridiculous, by the way. He was named also at the 150th year of college football, the greatest college football player of all time. Look up his stats. I'm not going to get – actually, it's too deep a dive to get into here. It's a little ridiculous. He had one great college football, so he's the greatest of all time.
On their behalf, you now have to come up with a name –
as somebody who played in the Super Bowl era. It's the only era that matters. Everything that happened before that is irrelevant. Jim Brown makes it into the Super Bowl era properly, but, you know, he's at the tail end and then he retires. But the reference that I've grown tired of that we did witness, and it was in fact dominant, I think we need an update just for the kids out there. It's like, hey, and people always use it in the pejorative about whomever you're talking about, like the Chiefs. Like, Chiefs might win the Super Bowl, but their defense ain't exactly the 85 Bears. The 85 Bears. So we've seen good defenses since then. Can't we update that one into the 21st century already?
Yeah, I agree.
All right. See, now we're off and running here with Jim Brown. Here's the next one for you. We'll give you one more in this episode. The Foo Fighters. Too hot, too cold? Are we overrating, underrating, or do we perceive them just right?
Foo Fighters are like a, as a band, are like a funny black comedian who you agree is funny but uses the N-word a lot, or a funny white comedian who just says motherfucker like all the time. Like, you're kind of like, that person is funny but doesn't need to do quite as much of this. Mm. And the Foo Fighters are a great band who have good songs. Not all are they're a little simple. I mean, they're basic. That can be fine, but I like a little more layer, a little more nuance. But the hair is fine. Okay, what if the supercut? What if they all had supercuts? What if the Foo Fighters all went to Fantastic Sam's? No, here's a challenge. I challenge everyone. What if I took the Foo Fighters to Fantastic Sam's and I got them all, you know, short crop, bowl cut, you know, tight around the ears, and then they went out and played a gig? I bet you, if my wife saw that gig and I went, how were the Foo Fighters? She'd go, not up to their usual. They didn't rock quite as hard. There was a little, maybe Dave's got a flu or something. It was a little subdued. Huh. I think a lot of it is hair flying. I think there's a lot of flying hair. And I think that's a, That's a part of it.
I think that it's true that people say that about comedians. You always hear, like, it really, the material, as important as it obviously is, it's the likability of the the guy, and that's what people kind of vibe to.
Likeability,
it's like,
hey,
everybody's like, Dave Grohl seems like a fun hang. He seems like a funny, nice guy, and the guys in the band seem that way. And I think they get a pass. I
good rock band.
They're fine.
Fine.
All their songs sound exact. There's a sound from each band. It's the same sound. Okay, I think we're all, so do we keep Caroli locks?
Yeah.
I like this. As a matter of fact, maybe we'll do it again tomorrow. In the meantime, though, for Adam Carolla, Dave Damaschek, Good Sports out.
Good Sports.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow Ace on Twitter at Adam Carolla. If you'd like to leave us a message, voicemail, the phone number is 888-634-1744. For tickets and info on everything, go to adamcarolla.com.